Okay, good morning, everyone. Thank you all for coming on this holiday weekend to study some Torah together. I happen to be very excited for the material that we'll be studying. It's been a sort of passion project for me to think deeply about the systems of Jewish leadership that exist, the systems of government, or I guess more broadly, leadership in general. And how those structures reflect on the values of our society. So as part of the Americana here, what we're going to do together is we're going to do a little bit of comparative work, examining the notion of separation of powers, that different powers of a government, different aspects of their authority are divided among different institutions and different people. And we'll consider the role that that concept serves both in American society as well as in Jewish or halachic society. Hopefully by the end, we'll be able to note some similarities, some contrasts, and at least for me, some unanswered questions or some partially answered questions that we'll have the chance to reflect on together. I'll mention now that the plan is for me to speak. I will be monitoring the chat, so if anyone has any questions, it would be easiest, I think, to put them in the chat as I go. Especially clarifying questions, it would be great to have the opportunity to clarify, you know, mid-presentation as opposed to at the end. So if there's anything that I'm saying that's unclear, please feel free to send questions in the chat or other reflections that you have. We'll either address them during the presentation or at the end when we finish. With those words of introduction, let's begin. I'll be sharing my screen for much of the time, but I'll also try to adjust the screen so that I'm able to see everyone as well. So just give me 1 second. Here we are. So like I said, what we'll be considering today is this notion of separation of powers, which for our purposes, let's define as the allocation of different roles and authorities to different institutions or to different individuals in positions of power in a society. The overall American government has a certain notion of separation of powers with a certain apparent purpose. I've chosen just one text that might reflect that purpose, which is from the Federalist Papers, a series of papers written around the time that the Constitution is being implemented, at sort of the founding of America or American government, that articulates a lot of the values or principles by which the American government is going to be conducted. So in Federalist Paper number 51, which was written by James Madison, we see an articulation of this doctrine or this notion of separation of powers and its specific purpose. So we'll read that together. To the people of the state of New York, to what expedient then shall we finally resort for maintaining in practice the necessary partition of power among the several departments as laid down in the Constitution? Here Madison is referring to this notion that we see in the Constitution in the first couple of articles, that different aspects of government are allocated to different individuals or different bodies. The legislative aspect of government are allocated to Congress, the executive is the president, and the judiciary falls in the Supreme Court and any subsidiary courts that are founded after the fact. So how do we maintain the necessary partition of power, this idea that these different functions will exist in their different domains? Madison answers, the only answer that can be given is that as all these exterior provisions are found to be inadequate, any external mechanism for maintaining the division of power is insufficient. The defect must be supplied by so contriving the interior structure of the government as that its several constituent parts may, by their mutual relations, be the means of keeping each other in their proper places. This is a notion that may be familiar to us, not as separation of powers, but as checks and balances. This idea that different domains of government exist separately and provide meaningful checks on one another's power. So to choose one example, and there are certainly many examples that can be given, the legislature has the power to enact laws. That's a power that it has. In order to keep that power in check, the executive authority has the authority to veto those laws, and that would prevent those laws from going into effect. Or the judiciary authority has the power to declare those laws unconstitutional if they are in fact unconstitutional. And that's another way of keeping that power in check. So lest you have a runaway legislature that's interested in overextending its authority, we have other branches of government that keep them in their proper places, to use Madison's words. And this notion gets emphasized in a paragraph slightly later on, but I found to be pretty powerful. But the great security against a gradual concentration of the several powers in the same department consists in giving to those who administer each department the necessary constitutional means and personal motives to resist encroachments of the others. Here, Madison is reflecting not on theory, on system of government sort of in the abstract, but on the people who compose or comprise the government. The provision for defense must in this, as in other cases, be made commensurate to the danger of attack. Ambition must be made to counteract ambition. The reason that checks and balances are necessary and the separation of powers, at least in part, is necessary is because man is ambitious. The people who compose the government certainly have at least enough ambition to be interested in positions in government. And so we require ambition to keep man's ambition in check. It may be a reflection on human nature that such devices should be necessary to control the abuses of government. But what is government itself but the greatest of all reflections on human nature? If men were angels, no government would be necessary. If angels were to govern men, neither external nor internal controls on government would be necessary. Madison's reflecting that the entire idea of limiting power is something that's necessary only because humans are governing human society, and humans are imperfect, and humans suffer from failures of judgment and from ambition and from all of the moral and intellectual flaws that could create significant problems if left unchecked. And so the systems of government exist to divide up that power and to manage it. In framing a government which is to be administered by men over men, the great difficulty lies in this. You must first enable the government to control the governed. The government needs to have sufficient power in order to serve its purpose, which is to legislate society, to control both international and domestic issues. And at the same time, in the next place, oblige it to control itself. It must also control itself so as not to run away with untrammeled power. Just to choose one example of this, and the rest of Federalist 51 reflects on numerous aspects of this. In Republican government, the legislative authority necessarily predominates, which is itself interesting, and many have noted that that isn't necessarily reflective of the overall trajectory of American history. But at least in theory, when the government was composed for Madison, the legislature was the most authoritative and powerful of the branches. And because it's the most powerful of the branches, it itself needs to have its power checked in more ways. The remedy for this inconveniency is to divide the legislature into different branches. So we have the House of Representatives and we have the Senate. And that in turn dilutes the power of the legislature so that it does not become too powerful. And to render them, by different modes of election and different principles of action, as little connected with each other as the nature of their common functions and their common dependence on the society will admit. And the idea of having two branches of government elected differently, functioning different ways, is to allow them to exist independently and have independent power that isn't dependent on each other. So this is the thrust, I think, of separation of powers and checks and balances in the American mode. It exists as a way of ensuring that government is able to wield sufficient power to do its job, on the one hand, but on the other hand, to ensure that no individual is put in a position where they have too much power and remain unchecked. I'm sorry, I'm noticing in the chat that I've been frozen a couple of times. Has that been an issue? If it is, I'm happy to. Yeah, please.
It's been good. I mean, no problems here.
Okay, let me just, by show of hand, anyone else having problems? I could see most people on the screen. Okay, it looks like it's been all right. Fantastic. Okay, so we'll continue. For anyone who's been having some connectivity troubles, this will be recorded, and anyone's interested in anything for which I was frozen, I'd be more than happy to further clarify. Okay. So in the American mode, separation of powers is about ensuring government is able to serve its function its legislative, executive, and judiciary functions, while not concentrating too much power in the hands of a single individual or a single body. Okay, we'll transition now to reflections on Jewish modes of leadership and more broadly, separation of powers that exists in Jewish contexts. And we'll see whether it serves exactly the same purpose that it seems to serve in the American model. So by means of introduction, I think this is both the most well-known but also the neatest source that articulates modes of Jewish power that exist is this Mishnah on Perkei Avot. Rabbi Shimon Omer, Shlosha Ktarim Him. There are three crowns. Crowns apparently is a symbol of authority. There are three crowns that exist. Keter Torah, the crown of Torah. Keter Kahuna, the crown of Kahuna of priesthood. The Keter Malchut, and the crown of royalty or kingship. And these are three modes of authority that exist within Jewish society as it conceives of itself. Now the Mishnah ends with the powerful notion, V'keter Shem Tov Ole Al Gabehem. The crown of having a good name or a good reputation transcends these other crowns and other modes of authority. You may have the power invested in you by being a priest or by being a king, or even by being a Torah scholar, but having a Shem Tov is a more important role according to this Mishnah. And that's a bit far afield for our purposes. What's more important for us is these three models, Torah, Kahuna, Malchut, as the three sources of Jewish authority. And we'll note a couple of sources that actually explicitly divide amongst those authorities and maintain different domains for those. And we'll see how those are articulated. So one distinction that exists is the distinction between kings and Kohanim, between the Malchut and the Kahuna. So one source, and I think most explicitly reflects on this notion, is a Ramban at the end of Sefer Bereishit. At the end of Sefer Bereishit, we find, that Yaakov is blessing all of his sons, the Berchos Yaakov at the very end of Bereishit. And when he gets to Yehuda, he says as follows, Yehuda, ata yoducha achacha, yodcha ba'oraf oivecha, yishachavu lecha b'nei avicha. Without getting into the interpretive issues in biblical poetry, we'll try to get to our content most directly. In Pasuk Yud, Lo Yasur Shevet Mi Yehuda, the Shevet, the scepter of leadership, will not be removed from Yehuda. Umechokek Mi Ben Raglav, Ad Ki Avo Shilo Velo Yikatamim. So the scepter should not be removed from Yehuda, the Mechokek, seemingly from the Shorish of Chukim, the legislator, the one who implements laws from Ben Ragla, from his descendants, Ad Ki Avo Shilo, until a Shilo will come, Velo Yikatamim. The interpretive issues, again, at the end of this pasuk are a little bit further afield from our purposes. But we're more interested in the beginning of the pasuk. The Shevet will never be removed from Yehuda. And the Ramban here reflects on what this means, this idea that the Shevet, the scepter of authority, is never removed from the tribe of Yehuda. Aval inya no, shalo yasur shevet mi Yehuda al achad me'achav. The scepter of kingship will not be removed from Yehuda and imposed or given to any of the other shvatim. That's not appropriate. Ki balchut Yisrael hamoshel aleihem mimena yiyeh. Whenever there is a Jewish government, that governance should be done by Yehuda. That's not to say that Yehuda will always have authority. There is such a thing as galut, where we lose our authority and are subject to the authority of other nations. But when we are self-governing and when we have our own kingship, that kingship should come from Yehuda. V'lo yimshol echad me'achav alav, and no other shevet should rule over him. And he concludes, and that should be the case until ad ki avo shilo v'lo yikat kol ha'amim lasut kulam kiritzono. V'zehu ha'mashiach. This is true until the end of times. Until Mashiach comes, and Mashiach also, being a descendant of Malchut Beit David of the Davidic dynasty, will also be a member of the tribe of Yehuda. Okay, so the idea that Yehuda will always have kingship so far doesn't weigh in on separation of powers, but the Ramban continues in a direction that's very important. V'zehaya unesh hachashmonaim shemalchu b'vayit sheni. The Hashmonaim, who rebel against the Greeks, who the heroes of the story of Hanukkah, erred in this area. They sinned in this area. even though kihayu chasidei elyon, even though they were lofty chasidim, they were pious people, v'ilmalei heim nishtachu ha-torah ha-mitzvot mi-Yisrael, and they fought such that Torah and mitzvot would never be forgotten from Bnei Yisrael. They fought against the Hellenistic influence and succeeded in so doing. But nonetheless, afal pichen enshu onesh gadol, they were still punished. Why? Because of this flaw. Ki arbat b'nei chashmonai hazakin, hachasidim, hamolchim ze et ze, al kol gvurotam v'atzlachatam, naflu b'yad oyvehem v'charev. The descendants of the chashmonaim were themselves kings. They appointed themselves as kings after they succeeded in their rebellion. And we know that there were Hasmonean kings during the Second Temple period. Their punishment for this was that they were overthrown or toppled, biyad oyvehem becharev, and they were killed by the sword. And this punishment for having taken over this seat of kingship from Yehuda is emphasized by Chazal as well in the next section that we won't spend too much time on. And the Ramban just doubles down on the fact that this is midah keneged midah. V'haya onsham midah keneged midah. This punishment of having lost their kingship is a just punishment. Shehim shil hakadosh baruch hu aleihem et avdehem vehem hichritum. They appointed themselves to be kings inappropriately in the place of Yehuda. And in turn, they were toppled from their kingship and ruled over by others. So one reading of the problem of the Chashmonaim, according to the Ramban, is that they took away the Shevet from Yehuda. Now, it's the next one that really is going to touch on our issue. I just saw someone sent me a message in the chat. So did Hashem set up Shaul to specifically fail as he was not from Yehuda? So that's a great question. It's in that question is sort of implicit in one of the ellipses in my rendering of the Ramban. The Ramban does deal actually with this question about Shaul. And he makes the claim that the reason the formulation of the pasuk is lo yasur shaven mi Yehuda, the scepter shall not be removed from Yehuda, means to convey that it won't be removed once it is given to Yehuda. So it was first given to Shaul for whatever purpose, and Ramban deals with that question as to whether that was an appropriate request on the part of Bnei Yisrael and Sefer Shmuel as well. But once it was given to Yehuda and given to Beit David, it will never be removed from Beit David. So that's the claim that Ramban makes elsewhere. Now to our core idea. Another aspect of this, of the problem of the Chashmonaim, the Afshar Gam Kain, Shaya Aleihem Chit B'Malchutam, Mipnei Shehayu Kohanim. Another problem in their having become kings is that they were Kohanim. They were priests. And priests should not become kings. V'nitzavu, the role of Kohanim, tishmeru et kunatchem l'chol devar ha-mizbeach, ulumibet la-paruchet v'avadetam avodat matana etain et kunatchem. The role of the Kohen is to work in the Beit HaMikdash, to work in the Mizbeach, to do the Avodah. V'lo haya lehem limloch, rak la-avod et avodat Hashem. They weren't meant to be kings, they were only meant to serve God and do avodat Hashem directly. Excuse me. This last section of the Ramban fleshes this out in a little bit more detail. I quote to Yerushalmi, for example, in Moshchim Melachim Kohanim, you should not appoint Kohanim to be Melachim. You should not anoint them to this purpose. And it concludes, Shehu manua min haTorah, it is prevented from by the Torah, Shlo yu Kohanim haLevi'im, kol shevet Levi chilek v'nachala b'malchut. The Kohanim and Levi'im should not have any place in kingship. And this matter is fitting and appropriate. Now, Ramban doesn't tell us why it is fitting and appropriate that Kohanim should not be kings. In the American model, the idea we might draw is to say that being in charge of the Mikdash, managing the direct Avodat Hashem, the Marachat HaKorbanot, the process of offerings, is one element of authority. And those who are imbued with that authority should not also take upon the authority of kingship. That increases the risk of abuse of power and concentrating too much authority in a single individual. That doesn't seem to be the thrust of the Ramban. It's not impossible because Roman doesn't give us enough information to really draw on. But that doesn't seem to me to be the thrust. To me, the thrust is really in this line that we spent a little bit of time looking at. V'lo haya lehem limloch, rak la'avod et avodat Hashem. It seems that the Ramban thinks that there's some kind of inconsistency between being a melech and serving God directly. They operate on different irreconcilable domains. Being a melech means being involved in the day-to-day governance of a society, navigating political conflicts, managing wars and self-defense, handling taxes and economics. And doing Avodat Hashem in the Mikdash is an entirely different domain. It is secluded from the rest of the nation. The Avodah happens only within the walls of the Mikdash and not elsewhere. That's been prohibited. And it engages directly with the spiritual and the sacral and not with the prosaic and the political. And I think that's the thrust of the Ramban. There are multiple different domains that shouldn't be merged, not because of concentration of power, but because of the possibility of infusing one domain with the other. Melucha should not be infused with this kind of removed sense of Avodat Hashem that's limited to the Beit HaMikdash. And Avodat Hashem should not be rendered prosaic by its intermingling with internal political matters. That seems to me to be the thrust of the Ramban. So we have this notion of separation of certain kinds of authority, but the separation is motivated not by concern of totalitarianism, but rather by the sort of inseparable nature, the irreconcilable nature of these two different domains of authority and of leadership. That exists as one model of the merging of different domains that is precluded by certain halakhic ideals. Another, and this is really where I came at the topic from, has to do with separation of the roles of the king and the courts. There's a very long passage here from a text called the Drashot Haran. There don't seem to be Drashot in the sense that we're now familiar with Drashot. There are much longer sort of philosophical reflections on a number of important topics. And the 11th Drasha of the Ran deals with philosophies of judgment and of government. So he begins with the beginning of Parshat Shoftim. Shoftim v'shotrim titin lecha b'chol sha'aracha. You should appoint judges and officers in all of your domains, all of your gates. Asher Hashem Elokecha notin lecha l'shvatecha. V'shavtu et ha'am mishpat tzedek. And those judges should judge the nation with mishpat tzedek. Now the driving problem, I think, for the Ran, he doesn't organize his information in this way. But the driving problem or the challenge for the Ran, is in dealing with two different sets or purposes of law, of mishpat, such that you have shoftim to implement that mishpat. He knows that one set of mishpat is the mishpat that's most directly reflected in halacha, where a person commits a crime, a person is brought to a beit din, the beit din will try them for that crime, and if found guilty, will apply one of the mitot beit din, one of the authorized capital punishments, or if not directly, you might have malkot or other forms of punishment that are implemented by a beit din. And the Ran notes a problem or at least a challenge in the implementation of such a system of government. The problem is that the standards that halacha imposes for that kind of judgment are incredibly high. He quotes a braita to this effect, that when interrogating witnesses in order to implement justice, we want to know that they've done, that the two witnesses both saw the act directly. We want to know that the two witnesses issued a warning to the person who committed the action. We need to know that the person who was warned accepted the warning verbally, said, I understand the warning and am doing this anyway. Even this idea of hitir asmo lemita, he has to take upon himself that he's doing an action that will justify the death penalty. And after accepting the warning of the witnesses who see a person committing a crime, then heimit b'toch kedei dibor, he has to commit the crime almost immediately afterwards, such that we know that at the time he committed the crime, he hadn't changed his mind. So the standard of implementing, let's say, a penalty for murder, for example, is so high as to be almost impossible. It would be almost impossible for a court system to try someone for the crime of murder if, in order to penalize someone for murdering, we need two witnesses to see the person, warn them, have the person explicitly accept the warning, and then kill immediately. And there are a number of other requirements as well, if we're interested in going down that kind of analysis. And the Ran says, it's true. Ve'en safek. Ki kol zeh ra'uy mitzad mishpat tzedek. All of that is necessary in terms of being a mishpat tzedek, a righteous judgment. Because in order to kill someone, in order to apply a death penalty, we need to know that a person committed a capital crime willingly, intentionally, knowingly. And therefore we need him to accept his hatra and all the other halachot that are necessary to that purpose. However, if you only were to punish people for committing crimes upon these standards, you've said Hasidur Hamedini Legamre, the organization of society would be lost. It would be impossible to maintain a society with those standards. Because murderers would abound and they would never fear punishment because they'd never be able to be punished. All you would need to do if you wanted to get away with murder by this system would be not explicitly say, I'm murdering knowing that I am about to be punished with the death penalty. And at that point, you would be safe. A society couldn't run under those circumstances. Therefore, there's an entire independent system of judgment that is created. Therefore, God commanded, in order to have a functioning society, that a king should be appointed, and the role of the king being to maintain the functioning of society. And one aspect of this is explicitly mentioned here. A king is able to judge and is able to implement laws and consequences for failure to uphold the laws without hatra'a. Hatra'a, this warning process that sets the standard for punishment very high, isn't necessary for a king. Because in order for society to function, you can't require that anyone who is punished need to meet that standard of hatra'a. And so the king is able to implement a system for society to function that does not require it. That, in accordance with that which is needed for the management or functioning of society. And just in brief here, Nimsa Sheminu HaMelech Shaveh BeYisrael UVeYeter Umot Shet Tzrichim LeSidur HaMedini. Both Bnei Yisrael and other nations require society to function. That's a necessary prerequisite for the existence of a nation or the existence of a society. And so they both require what we call Minui HaMelech or Mitzvat HaMelech, this idea of a king whose job it is to maintain the society. There's an additional mitzvah. There's another mitzvah that's unique to Bnei Yisrael, which is having shoftim, which is having a system of judgment that lives up to these high standards of v'shaftu et ha'am mishpat tzedek, this righteous judgment. And this system is managed by having pure, truthful, righteous judgments. Now, those judgments don't exist in the Ran's world to maintain a civil society. That's the job of the king. Rather, they exist, and he develops this idea in greater detail, in inyanam tikun hamidini klal. It's not about maintaining the functioning of society. Aval hanimshach mehem hu chol hashefa ha'eloki bumatenu vidavko imanu. It is so that there is a divine flow to our nation, to Am Yisrael, and God's connection to us is facilitated by our fulfilling these mitzvot. Just like any other mitzvah, it's true by the korbanot, it's true by the mikdash, that the purpose of doing these mitzvot is to have a connection between Am Yisrael and God. And so too, maintaining these judgments is also a fulfillment of achieving this shefa ha'eloki, this divine flow and divine connection between Am Yisrael and God. Now, again, we could ask the question that we asked about the Ramban. What is the motivation or the purpose of the separation of powers between the king and the court system, let's say the Sanhedrin or the Shoftim? I would submit that it's explicitly not for the purpose of separation of powers. This is how the Ran actually, at least in our section, will end with. There is a Gemara that suggests that this extra legal power or extra mishpat power that a king has to maintain society isn't limited to a king. Tanya Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov Omer, Shamati shebeitin makin va'unshin shalomin ha-Torah. He has heard that a beitin is allowed to inflict punishments not in accordance with mishpat tzedek, not in accordance with the Torah. Why? V'lo la'avor al devrei Torah, not for the purpose of violating the Torah. Ela la'asot siyag la'Torah, rather in order to make a fence around the Torah, to protect the Torah from its violators. For that purpose, one is allowed to implement punishments, even ones that are not strictly demanded by the letter of the law as it exists. That breita implies, shenira mimenu, sheminui ha-beitin hu lishpot kifi tikun ha'et v'hazman. It suggests that a beitin also has the power of legislating, creating laws, and enforcing laws in accordance with the needs of the time. The domain that we had previously dedicated to the king, we've now applied to the Sanhedrin or the Beit Din. And so it looks from that breita like the Beit Din has that authority and not the king. And the Ran says, well, not strictly, but yes. The Eino Kein. Avo bezmanche yubi Yisrael Sanhedrin v'melech. If you had both a Sanhedrin and a king at the same time, as was true historically during the time of the Beit HaMikdash, you would have a Sanhedrin and a king. HaSanhedrin him lishpot et ha'am b'mishpat tzedek levad. Lo letikun inenam b'yoter mizeh. So then the Sanhedrin would have its role of doing mishpat tzedek, of this divine form of justice, and the king would have the domain of managing a civil functioning society. However, aval ka'asher lo yiyeh melech b'Yisrael, ha'shofit yichlul shnei ha'kochot, koach ha'shofit v'koach ha'melech. When there is no king, the powers of the king are transposed onto the Sanhedrin, onto the Shofet, and they then have the power to implement both divine Mishpat Tzedek and human civil society and civil judgment. From this section of the Ran, I think it's clear that the idea is not to differentiate powers and to make sure that no one body has too much power. Because in the absence of a king, we explicitly allocate the king's powers to the Shofet, according to the Ran. And so the Shofet actually ends up with both the power of Mishpat Tzedek and the power of the Melech, the power of managing civil society. So it seems that for the Ran, just like for the Ramban, this notion of dividing up powers among different authorities, the, you know, Keter Torah, Keter Kahuna, Keter Malchut being separate, isn't as much about ensuring that no individual has too much power, but rather about ensuring the maintaining and ensuring the integrity of each domain individually. Mishpat Tzedek functions because it is not interested in managing civil society. It's able to uphold a lofty standard for what counts as true righteous judgment because it doesn't need to care about managing politics and managing a functioning society. That's already been handled by the king. And the king is able to manage society because for the purpose of managing a society, he doesn't need to be upheld to the loftiest, most perfect divine standards of judgment. Society can't work if one upholds those standards only. And so each domain functions individually when it's allowed to do so. And so the domains aren't mixed in the same person. When necessary, when there is no king, society still needs to function. We still need to appoint individuals to that role. And so the Shofet has to take on that responsibility. But ideally, we try to maintain the separateness of those roles, again, for the purpose of maintaining the integrity of their independent functioning. So just to take a quick recap of what we've seen so far, we've done a sort of comparative analysis between the notion of separation of powers and checks and balances in the American system, whose primary goal is to manage a human society, just to go back to the line that I liked so much. If men were angels, no government would be necessary. And if angels were to govern men, no external, neither external nor internal controls on government would be necessary. This idea of we're managing a society with men who have ambition. And so managing that power is something that's necessary. The halakhic models of separation of power that we've seen don't seem to rely on that notion. Now, this leads me to our conclusion or our final section, which to me is speculative. I don't have strong answers to this question, but I have partial answers to this question, which is the American claim is a strong claim. Madison makes a good point. When we appoint human people to positions of authority, power can be abused and ambition can go unchecked if we don't have checks and balances. One example of this comes from this incredibly powerful story that is cited in the Gemara in Sanhedrin. We'll look at it very briefly, and we'll look at it in English just for the sake of time. The Mishnah in Sanhedrin had claimed that kings neither are eligible to serve as judges in courts, nor are they eligible to be judged by a court. And the Gemara, after limiting it to specifically Malchei Yisrael and not Malchei Yehuda, for reasons that are a little bit beyond our scope right now, the Gemara asks, but what is the reason that others do not judge the kings of Israel? Why are the kings of Israel not subject to judgment? For the following reason, it's based on a historical occurrence that shows a flaw in having kings being judged. It is because of an incident that happened. As a slave of Yanai, the king killed a person. This is during the Second Temple period. We have a king, Yanai HaMelech. So one of his slaves had killed someone. Shimon ben Shetach said to the sages, put your eyes on him and let us judge him. Despite the fact that he's a king, he's subject to our judgment. He is theoretically culpable for the murder that his slave had committed. They sent word to Yanai, your slave killed a person. Yanai sent the slave to them. They sent word to Yanai, you also come here. As the verse states with regard to a shore that gored a person to death, he should be testified against with his owner. And this Gemara assumes that the owner of an ox has to come to court to be judged with his ox if that ox has committed a murder, and the same thing is true for a slave as well. So the Gemara continues to narrate. Yanai came and sat down. Shimon ben Shetach said to him, Yanai, the king, stand on your feet and witnesses will testify against you. And bear in mind, it is not before us that you are standing to give us honor, but it is before the one who spoke and the world came into being that you are standing. You are standing before God. And stand in judgment. We will now judge your case. Yanai the king said to him, I will not stand when you alone say this to me, Shimon ben Shetach, who is on the court, but according to what your colleagues say. And if the whole court tells me to stand, I will stand. So we see this clash of power. We have the king who's sitting in judgment, and Shimon ben Shetach, who is trying to enforce judgment upon him. But Shimon ben Shetach looks around. Shimon ben Shetach turned to his right. The judges forced their faces to the ground out of fear and said nothing. He turned to his left, and they forced their faces to the ground and said nothing. When the king is in court and on trial, the judges are afraid to do their job. They're afraid to implement justice fairly. This is a failure on the part of the judges, to be explicit. Right? This is a lack of courage in the face of kings, the courage necessary to uphold divine judgment. Right, if we were going to use the Ron's terminology from before, Mishpat Tzedek, righteous judgment. And Shimon ben Shetach takes them to task for it. You are masters of thoughts, enjoying your private thoughts and not speaking. So may the master of thoughts, God, come and punish you. And immediately the angel Gabriel came and struck those judges to the ground and they died. But the conclusion of that story highlights challenges in enforcing Torah and challenges in abuse of power. At that moment, when they saw that the Sanhedrin does not have the power to force the king to heed its instructions, the king being above the Sanhedrin, apparently at least in influence, if not in theory, the sages said, a king does not judge others and others do not judge him. A king, or at least Yanai, the king, was able to transcend the judgment of the judges. That means that de facto, even if in theory he is subject to their judgment, in practice his power did go untrammeled. He did not subject himself to the authority of the courts. This, I think, strengthens the Federalist problem or Madison's problem. When people have ambition, how do we keep it in check? What are the mechanisms that we have to do so? The beginnings of an answer, and I do mean the beginnings because this is a question on which I'm still thinking, and I would love to hear the thoughts that others have on this, is that there is a difference, I think, between civil society in America and Torah society. Torah society legislates from above. In theory, at least, every human person is subject to divine authority. The rules of the Torah are meant to apply to everyone. When they can't apply, one has to be strategic and decide, are we going to try to judge kings when they won't listen to our judgment anyway? But there is a supererogatory authority that is meant to keep power in check, as opposed to in the American system, where man has ambition, right? There aren't angels involved. There are only men. And man's ambition has to be kept in check with the power of others. And so different humans will, you know, have different spheres of authority that will hopefully keep each other in check. The Torah system, at least in theory, I think, envisions itself as being from the top down. As long as the Torah is being followed, power will be kept in check. There are a few areas where I see Torah-imposed checks on power, specifically in the domains that we're talking about. So for example, just to go back to our Mishnah and Avot, we have seen the domains of the king, Keter Malchut, Keter Kihuna, and Keter Torah. And each one, I think, has some checks on power. Keter Torah, seemingly the fewest, but we'll see some of those as well. So for example, the Torah, when legislating the authority of a king, says, Rak lo yerbelo susim, the king should not have too many horses, lest v'lo yeshiva ta'am Mitzrayim l'maan harbot sus, lest he want to bring the nation back to Egypt in order to acquire greater wealth for himself. V'lo yerbelo nashim, and he should also not have too many wives. V'chasef v'zahav lo yerbelo ma'od, and he should not have too much wealth. And in addition to these limitations on what a king is allowed to own, there's a positive kind of limitation as well. Vayakishivto al kisei mamlachto, as he sits in the seat of his kingship. V'chatov lo et mishneh ha-Torah hazot al sefer milifnei ha-kohanim ha-leviim. He must write himself a copy of the Torah. V'hayta imo v'karavo kol yemei chayav. And that Torah will be with him and he will read in it every day. The Torah is meant to be a check on the power of the king. Leman yilmad liyirat Hashem elokav, so that he does not see himself as above God. He will learn to fear God. Lishmor et kol divrei ha-Torah hazot, and to observe the rules of the Torah, v'techukim ha'ila la'asotam. Livilti rum levavo me'achav, lest he can see himself as above his brothers, and lest he see himself as not bound by the Torah. The purpose of these halachot is to keep the king's power in check. Similarly, there are halachot about a kohen that I think have the effect of keeping the kohen in check. This is a little bit less explicit, but within the same area of the Torah in Parshat Shoftim, we see some of these limitations as well. V'lo yiyeh l'kohanim ha-levi'im kol shevet levi, chilek v'nachala im Yisrael. Kohanim and levi'im, whose domain is the Mikdash and Avodat Hashem, do not have a portion in the land of Israel. They do not have an inheritance in that land. In fact, the Kohanim are explicitly made dependent on the rest of the nation. When they offer offerings, it comes from the nation. When offerings are given, then they take a section. And they also have a share of produce. But all of their wealth and all of their property comes from the people. So lest the priestly class, the Kohanim, rise above anyone else in the nation, their power is also kept in check by Torah legislation when they're limited to what the people provide them. So we have a limitation on the Keter Kahuna and a limitation on the Keter Malchut imposed by the Torah, not necessarily directly by other people. Now, the limitations on the Keter Torah are a little bit harder to pin down. I will note just a Rashi on that Mishnah we hadn't spent so much time reflecting on. Rashi notes the difference between the Keter Torah and the other two Keterim. Rashi notes, Ve'achad eino doma l'shnayim, levi she'ein ha'shnayim shavim b'chol adam, Keter Kahuna and Keter Malchut can't be claimed by anyone. Adam liyot kohen, im kein hu mizera hakuna. A person can't become a kohen unless he is descended from kohanim. V'chein iefshar lo liyot melech, im kein ra'ui lemalchut. And a person can't become a king unless he is fitting to become the king. However, ulecheter Torah efshar lo, b'chol mishiyasok ba, any person can earn the keter Torah. So the keter Torah is qualitatively different from the Keter Kahuna and the Keter Malchut. This is the point that other commentaries on this Mishnah also make. The Keter Torah is democratic in a way that the Keter Kahuna and the Keter Malchut are not. So already one check on the power of Torah is that if a person has the power of Torah and is abusing it, others can also claim the power of Torah by learning Torah and by themselves becoming ra'ui for the roles that being a master of Torah can give. And that already serves as at least a partial check on the power of anyone abusing the Keter Torah. There are other checks on that power, it seems. And for me, this is really the area where I have the least to say, but at the same time, the most sort of ungrounded reflections. Another check on the Keter Torah is others with the Keter Torah. A Gemara that I actually just saw, I was learning with my father yesterday. We just briefly seen this Gemara. Minayin the dayan she yodea lechaveru shehu gazlan, minayin shlo yitzarefimo. How do we know that a judge who knows that his colleague in justice is a thief, how do we know that he should not serve on a court with this other judge? Tamunomar midvar sheker tirchak. One must stay away from a dvar sheker, from a falsehood. Implicit in this Gemara is two things. Number one, it's possible to have a dayan who is a gazlan. It is possible that a dayan in a position of Torah-imposed power could also fail to live up to the standards of being a dayan, could become a thief. That's one aspect of it. It's the acknowledgement of this potential for corruption. And at the same time, there's a check on that. Other dayanim refuse to sit with that dayan, and that dayan loses his ability to judge. So if there is a corruption within the class of judges, the class of dayanim who wield, so to speak, the Keter Torah, while others in that class are able to keep them in check. It's a little bit harder when a king can't be kept in check by other kings, given that there will at any given time only be one. Other potential aspects of the checks on power might come from the requirements for being a judge. I just chose a few psukim that articulate this. Right, this is from the section where Yitro is telling Moshe how to set up a system of courts. What are the standards for being judges? In order to be a judge, one must be anshei chayil, yirei elokim, men of valor who fear God, anshei emet, men of truth, sonei vatsa, those who hate bribery, hate corruption. And so in order to be a judge, one must live up to moral standards of a certain sort. That also sets a bar for being judges that'll be hopefully harder to clear and hopefully a check on the ability for judges to abuse power, if they are in fact men of truth, and those who hate bribery, they're less likely to become corrupt in that way. And a final potential avenue that puts a check on the Keter Torah comes from this Ramban, which I'll summarize outside just in the interest of time. The Ramban here is dealing with a sort of niche question in the context of the halachot of Edim Zomimim. If anyone has learned Masechet Makot before, this notion might be familiar. There is a halacha called Edim Zomimim, where if two witnesses testify about a person that he's subject to some punishment, whether a monetary punishment or a capital punishment, and are themselves found to be lying under certain circumstances, they are subject to the same punishment that they intended to inflict on the other person. Vasitim lo kasher zamam. We do to them that which they tried to do. But the halacha, interestingly enough, is that that punishment only applies if they tried and failed to implement a punishment. If two witnesses tried to get someone killed but failed to do so, then they would themselves be subject to the death penalty. However, if they succeeded, they would not be subject to the death penalty. Ramban is dealing with this question. Why should that be, that if two witnesses falsely testify about a person that he is subject to the death penalty and is actually killed as a result, that they don't get killed? They've committed murder, just murder with words, but nonetheless, murder. And Ramban's answer is that there's a certain kind of divine hashra'ah. There's certain divine presence or divine hashkacha, I guess, supervision over a properly constituted court, such that a properly constituted court wouldn't be able to unfairly punish. Va'od, shelo yitein Hashem ha-shoftim ha-tzadikim ha-umdim lefanav lishpoch dam naki. God wouldn't allow true judges who are in good faith trying to pursue truth, God wouldn't allow them to commit a crime like this. So if witnesses came to testify about a person and were able to succeed, it must be that on some level, that person was really worthy of a death penalty. It couldn't be that God would allow this kind of failure in the court. So to abstract this principle, perhaps a final, at least conceptual check on judicial or Keter Torah power is this divine hashkacha, this idea that God is involved in judicial decisions such that they are less likely to be made in error and more likely to reflect truth on some level or to some end. So to just recap this last section that we've seen, these various checks on power, right, unlike in, I think, the American model, in which checks on power are imposed by people on other people, those who wield power are held in check by those who wield different set of power. Here, in I think the Torah system as it sees itself, the checks on power come from above. They come from the Torah, they come from God. And those checks are meant to keep power in check. Now, those don't always function, right? Kings, you know, Shlomo being one example, Shlomo did pursue wealth and did pursue many wives and did pursue Harbot Sus, and in turn, you know, was corrupted. And this is the challenge of any kind of society, is how do we make sure that the checks on power are successful and are adhered to? And that is itself a conversation. But those checks aren't meant to come from other human people. They're meant to come from above and thereby take each of these separate domains, which each serves some function in a Jewish society as it sees itself, and keep that power in check. Okay. So I'll stop the recording now, but I would be very happy to stay on and hear reflections or thoughts on what we've been looking at.